The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning, I want to talk about training. In Buddhism, all schools of Buddhism, almost all schools of Buddhism, put a big emphasis on training. It's such a big emphasis in Buddhism that there was a high school student who came to the monastery, and he's supposed to do a report, so he thought he'd go and interview the abbess. And so he asked if he could interview her about his report, and she said yes. And so he sat down with a piece of paper, and he said, "What is it you believe in here at the monastery?" And she said, "You're not going to learn much about the monastery with that question. A better question is to ask, what do we train in? What do we train in here?" And the story reminds me of something Brother David Stendelrost said many years ago. He's a Catholic monk who spent some time at Tassajara practicing with the Zen people there. Spent a lot of time around visiting Zen Center over the years as well. And he said that he feels he has more in common with Buddhist monastics than he does with ordinary lay Christians. And I think why he says that is because they both have a form of training which is comparable, very similar. And so some of the ways in which they're changed is very similar. For people who don't have a practice, don't have a training, they might have all kinds of beliefs, but it doesn't get embodied, it doesn't enter into their how they behave, it doesn't kind of change who they are. And monastic life, or not monastic, but Buddhist life, really focuses on transformation, of changing who we are. And so the training is part of that. So then this high school student asked the abbess, "Well, can you tell me something about training here in your monastery?" And she started off by saying, "Well, there's generally two ways of understanding of what training is about in Buddhism. And one way of understanding it is that it's like if you live in the Mojave Desert or Salt Lake City or someplace, and you've never been to the Pacific, then you might train to do that long walk. And make yourself strong enough so you can do that long walk and you practice getting to the Pacific." That's one way of training. The other way of understanding of training is like learning how to swim when you're standing in the ocean. You're already in the Pacific Ocean. You're standing in the water, your ankles, and then you're going to learn to swim. And it's not a matter of getting to the ocean. You're already there. The goal is the ocean. And so one way of training in Buddhism is that we train in the context that we're already in the truth. We're already somehow home. We're already, in Zen they talk about we're already perfect just the way we are. We train here, in this reality here. I remember Suzuki Roshi, a Zen teacher who in his book Zen My Beginner's Mind, who puts a big emphasis on this idea we're perfect, just things are perfect just the way they are. At the same time, he talks about how do you practice with the tragedy. He talks about in the book, I think in the book he talks about, if a parent loses a child, a young child or a child, any child, how do you sit with that? How do you practice with that? And, he lost his wife. His wife was murdered in his temple. So he knew about sitting in tragedy. And he talked about how important it is to just sit. Because if you sit, for him, training or sitting fully, after a while, the sitting, the sense of presence, the immediacy, the fullness of this reality right here, takes precedence over the intellectual ideas and memories and stories, concepts, fears that we have. And it changes the context of how we relate to what's happening. So do we sit, do we train already feeling connected, or do we train in order to get to the ocean? And so those are two different ways. And both ways are quite fine to have. And you don't get to choose which one you get. Different people, for whatever reason, have different backgrounds that bring them to different understandings of what they're doing when they're doing Buddhist practice. So one way or other, training is really important in Buddhism. And it partly arises out of an understanding, which is, I think, an ordinary understanding, but sometimes when you put it in religious terms, it seems kind of lofty or challenging, an understanding that the human mind can be trained. And we know that because we train children. We train them to learn the ABCs. And we train them to learn to read. We train them how to play musical instruments. We train them many ways. And a lot of that training comes from repetition. I had no idea that I'd be reciting ABC, singing that song, as many times as I have in the last year since I was having kids. Over and over and over again. And so I don't know if I was trained. I'm pretty trained now. But my kids are as well. And so anybody who learns a new language, for example, is training. Learning a musical instrument is training. Training is shaping the mind. Learning a skill, learning a craft, and learning a sport. And generally, when we're training for those kinds of ordinary things, we don't expect to succeed the first time we try. But it's called training because we do it repetitively, over and over and over again. Oftentimes, something very simple and that we have to master, and we do it over and over again until it kind of enters in deeply into our, nervous system, into our muscles, and becomes kind of almost second nature. I remember growing up, we used to go skiing sometimes when I was a kid, and I was amazed at the memory from the end of one winter to the beginning of the next winter. Somehow the internal memory of remember how to do it. And then I didn't ski for most of my adult life until I was, I don't know, I went skiing, tried again when I was about 45. And so I hadn't skied for 30 years. And I was really surprised the memory was still there. You know, somehow I'd been shaped and those synaptic routes knew their way from that repetition over and over again. And so the mind can be shaped, and our synaptic pathways can be shaped, our muscles can be shaped and trained. And so Buddhism takes this truth and says you can shape your mind, you can shape yourself in such a way that you have a mind which is much freer, much happier, much more fluid with the world around you. And so Buddhism understands, and partly the kind of background for Buddhism is that Buddhism understands the mind not to be a thing. It's not the brain. The mind is a process within the brain, and it's a series of processes, and processes are fluid unless they're frozen. And as we get older sometimes, not necessarily older, but with time, some people get frozen, locked in certain ways of thinking, certain ways of understanding, certain ways of behaving, certain ways of seeing, perceiving, and becomes very deeply ingrained habits that it's very hard to break out of. And so it's very hard to kind of... And so we talk about being frozen, and part of the function of Buddhist training is to help to unfreeze the ways in which we're stuck in particular mental patterns. The mind is more like water than wood. So it's water. Sometimes the water freezes, and then you have to thaw it. Sometimes our mind has to be thawed, and it takes a while. But our mind is also like water, and it'll take the shape of any container you put it in. It's easily influenceable, just like a wind blows across the lake. It pushes the water, creates little waves, and or a current comes along, whatever it happens. The water can be shaped and moved. You can splash in the water. So the same thing with the mind. The mind is very influenceable. And we see that particularly with children. They're very impressionable. And they can be impressed by all kinds of influences that come along their way. But so can we as adults. And it's quite, I think, humbling to realize how much we can be influenced by other people, by the environment, by our culture, by our society. And people's views about things can change slowly over time. A story that I kind of remember well is in the early 90s, I had this very old Toyota that I lived with. I lived with. We were close. In the early 90s, I lived in San Francisco, and I was very happy, content with my Toyota. And then at some point, I moved down here to the peninsula, and I started. Our group used to be in Palo Alto. I was going to school at Stanford, and I used to drive my my beautiful red Toyota around Palo Alto. And at some point, I noticed I started having these thoughts that, having a new car would be good. And I was being influenced by the fact that I had like the oldest car in Palo Alto. It was kind of like beat up and slow, and I knew there was one person who was embarrassed that their spiritual teacher had this car. And so I could see that it was kind of this slowly drifting into my mind, because now I was in a different kind of community, with different kind of situation, different cars than what I was used to in San Francisco, and it was pushing my mind to start thinking, oh, new car thoughts, wouldn't that be nice? And I didn't need a new car, but I could see it moving that direction. So I suspect that some of you can be influenced that way as well, and some of that's invisible, as when we watch, the popular media that kind of inundates us with lots of impressions they want to impress on us. And in fact, if we don't take responsibility for how our mind is shaped, there's plenty of people who want to do it for you. And part of Buddhist training is to take this ordinary fact that the mind is impressionable, is shapeable, is trainable, and take some responsibility for it. Because if you don't, your mind's going to be trained regardless. That's the nature of the mind, as it gets trained. The Buddha said, whatever is thought and pondered upon frequently becomes the inclination of the mind. Inclination, that's where the mind goes. So if you think a lot about, greedy things, greed, or lusty things, then the mind inclines more and more in that direction. If you think more about wisdom, about generosity, about love, the mind inclines towards that more. If you think more about peace, practice, letting go, the mind inclines towards that. If you incline the mind to think about what you want to hold on to and grasp or resist, the mind inclines towards that. So Buddhist training is to take responsibility for this aspect of the mind and to train it, to take some direction. It doesn't have to be dramatic. Some people get a little bit resistant to the idea of training the mind because it sounds exhausting. They're already exhausted. And they're telling me to do even more. One of the ways we train the mind is to train the mind to do less. We train it to rest, to relax. And some people, that's what the primary training they need to do when they first come to Buddhism, is to thaw out, to chill out, to relax, to settle. And that's a real big challenge to do that for some people. So what I'd like to do is to offer a variety of functions of training, different aspects of training. One of the functions of training is to help us to meet ourselves, to see ourselves more clearly. And it's the principle that sometimes only if you limit yourself can you really see what goes on with you. If you have unfettered freedom to do whatever you want, you might not see how much you're driven by your desires. But when your desires can't be fulfilled, only then do you see, wow, I didn't realize how compulsively driven I was by these desires that I have. So part of Buddhist training classically has been to put yourself in a situation that limits you, not because you're supposed to be limited, but so you can discover the unlimited mind by seeing how you're limiting yourself by the particular ways that you are stuck. So, say you have a credit card that has no limit, you have an infinite bank account, Then you could go out and you can shop to your drop. You can just shop away freely and buy whatever you want, and it's very nice, buy. And it just seems it's nice to, you could say to your friends, oh, but buying's nice. I could take it or leave it as, just an easy thing to do. And then, your bank account goes dry. And you try to, use a credit card, and they won't take it. And then you realize how addicted you were to buying. You had no idea there was just, all the things that buying meant. You didn't realize that buying things meant security, it meant comfort, it meant status, it meant identity, it meant, holding on to your friends because you can show off or buy it to them, but then things, whatever. And you had no idea. So by limiting yourself to not being able to buy, you see all the momentum that might be invisible if you just acted out freely. Does that make some sense, what I'm saying? In meditation, for example, you limit yourself by choice, I hope. you decide to sit down, close your eyes, and not move for a period of time. For some people, especially when you're new to this, that can be very hard. There can be strong compulsions to move, to do something. There could be a strong compulsion to go and eat, or go and check for email, or go and defrost the freezer. Or there could be strong movements to move, to scratch an itch, or to make yourself more comfortable. And by having some reasonable commitment not to move, you're limiting yourself. And in that limitation, you get these strong impulses, compulsions, beliefs, desires, aversions get highlighted, get seen more clearly. And in that process, you see yourself in a much deeper, fuller way than you would if you had great freedom to do whatever you want. So some people might hear this with a big surprise because Buddhism emphasizes freedom. And that was the good news, right? I'm good, I'll come and be free. But the way to be free is not to be able to do whatever you want, but to become free of what you want, to be free of desire. And then you can do much more, then you can be much more free in the world. Freedom from desire rather than freedom to act on all desires. So part of training is to limit yourself. And so meditation can do that. Spending time on retreat can do that. Where your life becomes very, very radically reduced on retreat, meditation retreats, where there is no television, media, computers, there is no telephones, there's very little social talking, almost no social talking going on. Maybe you get less sleep than usual, and there's a schedule which is not your choosing. And so you have to follow the schedule that is not your choosing. And food, they serve you food which is not your choosing. And so you have to kind of contend with that. Unfortunately, the food is very good, usually. And, it would be much better training if it was lousy food. So that's part of the function of training, is to help us see ourselves, meet ourselves. And it's a really powerful and significant thing to really meet yourself in a really deep way that this kind of limiting part of training can do. And then a second part function of training, which builds on that, is part of training is to do house cleaning. So once we meet ourselves and see ourselves, they start cleaning house. And realizing that perhaps you have unresolved issues in your life that needs to be cleaned up. Perhaps you need to go apologize to someone or make amends for something. Perhaps you need to finish something you promised you would do but never did. There's all kinds of things that can bubble up when you sit down and see yourself, like you do in meditation. And sometimes it requires some in the world house cleaning, but it might require some in the mind house cleaning, in the heart house cleaning. Perhaps there are things we realize we have to let go of, we have to understand more deeply, we have to kind of change our values a little bit. It doesn't make sense anymore to live along those values, so I have to kind of figure out a different way of living. So once we meet ourselves, we can do the house cleaning. And part of the function of training is to start having the time and the inclination to do that house cleaning that has to happen. Another aspect of training in Buddhism is what's called cultivation. This is the, you know, there's no real good Buddhist word, ancient Buddhist word, for our word meditation. And it comes as a big surprise since Buddhism is associated with meditation so much. The word that that kind of is comparable in Buddhism is the word bhavana, which means cultivation or development. And meditation is one part of trainings of cultivating the mind and the heart. And I like the word cultivating a lot because I liken it to a farmer who's going to, you know, cultivating a field, tending, nurturing something, patiently allowing things to grow. And periodically in the history of Buddhism, teachers have emphasized that practice is like tending, like being a farmer. Slow and patient. You plant a seed, you water it, you keep tending it, pull away the weeds, and you let the plant grow in its own way. You can't rush the plant. You can't pull the corn seed out, the corn seedling out of the ground in order to encourage it to grow better. You know, you need to store the corn seedling. And so you have to kind of be very patient and slow. And the gradual approach to practice is one that, this cultivation is one that's the hallmark of much of Buddhism, right down from the time of the Buddha to Zen, to Suzuki Roshi, emphasized also that training is slow and gradual. So there's many things that are cultivated. You cultivate a capacity to be more at ease, to be relaxed, if that's what's needed. You cultivate a greater capacity for mindfulness and to be present. Cultivate a greater capacity for concentration and be focused. Cultivate a greater capacity to love, to be loving, to have kindness, to have compassion. You don't leave things like love to chance, but you can spend time actually cultivating, developing that capacity. Not as something artificial, but something that can blossom in its own natural way from the heart. We cultivate our capacity to be ethical. We cultivate our capacity to be generous, to become more, have more generosity. And a lot of these forms of training come from actually doing the activity we're trying to train ourselves to be. So we become more generous by being generous. We become more loving by starting to love. We become more mindful by being mindful. So and mindfulness lays at the heart of this, and I'd like to quote Ralph Waldo Emerson. If we think of mindfulness as being maybe synonymous to watching, Emerson said, "Watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become deeds. Watch your deeds, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. And character is everything." End of the quote. So, it starts with a word, starts with a thought, and builds from that. So part of the mindfulness is to start tracking not just our behavior, but down at the very root where it all begins, with a thought. And so part of the training is to begin training ourselves to have the proper understanding, healthy understanding about, what to think about. To take responsibility, not just for our behavior and our beliefs, but responsibility for what the mind actually thinks, moment by moment. Think that which is useful and productive. So, So a big part of Buddhist training has to do with this cultivation aspect. It's slow. It takes a lot of repetition. I'd be curious to know what the count is for how many times, how many breaths I've watched. You know, I've been following my breath now since I was 20. You know, so that's been 36 years. Of every day, pretty much. Every day. Meditating, following my breath, being with my breath. I guess I could just, I should do the calculation. I can probably kind of get, some order of magnitude. It's a lot. A lot of repetition. If when I was 20, someone said, you know, you're going to attend to 120 million breaths, I would have gotten bored, or I wouldn't have believed them, or something. But that repetition, coming back over and over and over again, brings a lot of benefit. It's a limitation, so we get to see what's going on more clearly. It's a training in mindfulness, concentration. It's a training in letting go. It's a kind of house cleaning, and it kind of helps us to empty out all the extra stuff. I find focusing on the breath is a great way of leaving myself alone. I have a great capacity of not leaving myself alone, trying to fix things or judge things or run away from things or avoid things and all kinds of wonderful machinations of the mind. And so when I sit down and stay with my breath, then all those kinds of ways in which I try to interfere with my life kind of fall away, and I can just be more simply and really see what's here and be with myself in a deeper, more intimate and beneficial way. So repetition, over and over and over again, the virtue of repetition. And then the last thing I want to say about training today is a really important aspect of Buddhist training. The Buddhist training is really important. People get inspired by it. It's very meaningful to people. People will throw themselves into it. Some people will find great benefit from it and grow in the process of doing it. And so it's all wonderful. And now this last really important aspect of Buddhist training is it's one of the functions of it. It has to be one of the functions of it. So you have to listen carefully. Is one of the functions of doing Buddhist trainings is so you can fail at it. So you can fail at it. What do you think of that? Sooner or later, you're going to fail at it. And it's not going to go the way you want. You're not going to go as far as you want, or it's not going to work. And that is, some people say that's when practice really begins. That's when the training really begins. It's not a failure that you failed. Then you get to look at yourself. You get to meet yourself and understand yourself much better. And like, for example, some people hold on to Buddhist practice as a lifesaver. They just cling to it so tightly. And they have to look, you know, what's needed is to let go of the grip. It doesn't work to cling to it. Some people have a strong identification to Buddhist practice as if they're going to be a better, you know, they're going to be able to be the best person on their block. They get to wear a badge, the Buddhist badge. And so if they succeed in doing Buddhist training, then they know they're successful. They know they've been a good person. You know, I'm doing all this Buddhist practice for a while, and my parents don't approve of it, or my kids don't approve of it, and, you know, they tell me I'm going to be a loser, and I have to prove them wrong. I have to show them I have great success and get a PhD in Buddhism or something. just so that, you know, you can kind of really, you know. And so when you fail, then you get to look at all the kind of extra, all those unfortunate ways in which people relate to it. All the unfortunate ways which relate to ourselves. All the attachments, the clinging, the fears connected to it. And perhaps, at some point, what's important is not the further growth in greater mindfulness, greater concentration, but rather is the radical letting go of all the things we're holding on to, including success and all the things that success means. Some people so-called succeed for a long time in practice, and then they fail. Some people fail right away. And I don't know which is better. But it only works if you don't give up because of it. Failing in training only works if you continue the training with a failure. If you hang in and carry on with it and realize this is a very important part of the practice for it not to work. And then turn around and look at what your beliefs, what your attachments, what your clinging are, what's going on there. And see, and ask yourself, is there something important I need to let go of here? Not to let go of the training, but to let go of how I hold it, how I think about it, so that I can find a more peaceful, more productive, more useful way of holding and being present for it. Maybe not so greedy, or not so desperately, or not so not tying it to my self-identity, that my worthwhileness as a human being is going to only happen when I succeed in practice. Only when, So I hope you all have really good failures at this as well. I hope you have good success. I hope you succeed really well in your training. I hope that the training, the Buddhist training, helps you to meet yourself rather than take you away from yourself. Because if it takes you away from yourself, then you'll fail sooner. And because really, Buddhism is about really, in some ways, to leave yourself alone, to meet yourself, and find out how to be really at peace here with who you are. And I like to think that Buddhist training is very respectful of each person's uniqueness. You're not supposed to end up like a cookie-cutter Buddhist. But to really meet yourself, respect yourself, and then begin to take responsibility for what you see there, and begin having more choice about how you're going to shape this heart, beautiful heart and mind that we have, that you have. And cultivate and develop the qualities which you'd like to have, that you want to live with. And then find some value, meaning, in failing at it. Because as you fail at it, then you can let go more deeply. This is especially true at the upper ends of practice, when practice gets really, really deep. At some point you see the limitations of the very practice itself. And you realize that even the practice, what you're holding on to, has to be let go of. And in the end, in the very end at least, you have to completely let go of the training itself, while still training. So I hope that makes some sense to you today. I hope that it inspires you to train. And if you can train as if you're already in the ocean, that's great. And if you're still getting to the ocean, that's great too. In the ocean of truth. So thank you.